says Arum, he actually does not directly relate the word Arum in terms of naked, or an Arum in terms of somebody who's cunning, or whatever word it was yesterday, but I like his explanation of the word Arum in the context of a person's mental capacity. He says, Arum mitzayen ov denotes mishiyesh bokach ha'arma, somebody who has the power of arma, what is that? L'shkom kol davar terem asoso, to weigh everything before you do it. So it's a specific trait of an arum, is somebody who can weigh things before they occur, and anticipate and project what's going to happen as a result. He says, Arum, the person who's Arum, who has it as the antithesis of a Peti. The opposite of an Arum. I'm going to just throw this out. Is there garbage in here?
Give me help.
Arum is anticipating and project. And a peti is the opposite. A peti is somebody who's, the word peti in Hebrew is related to the word pitui. Pitui means seduction. So somebody who's seduced to do something is persuaded to do something even though the ramifications of this thing are probably going to be very, very negative. In other words, somebody does something for the short-term gratification, even though in the long term this will be something which is very negative to that person. So that's a peti, a person who's easily seduced, easily persuaded to do things. And Arum, on the other hand, is somebody who carefully considers the future and what it's going to bring as a result of his activities. So that's what he says, the peti who ma'amin chodavar, he believes everything. The egar min amumik, he doesn't have the trait of amumik, Rachel, who I am, to consider and analyze, reshkol, and weigh, drachos haluchosa, right? Those things which he, those are his pathways and the ways that he is going. And he says that, an interesting thing, he says, Hagam sha'arum enochah. He says that arum is not the same thing as a wise man, as a sage. And he does not receive the laws of knowledge, of logic, of wisdom, from other sages, to know their pathways. Nevertheless, he is not a pasty, and his mind is capable of distinguishing between good and bad, and truth and falsehood. And this allows him to carefully understand his way and not to believe everything and anything before he checks it out and weighs it with his mind and considers how to do the thing in the proper way in order to bring about the purpose which he wants. Now, sometimes, of course, a person who's crazy says, a person who's cunning, meaning he does the same thing, anticipating what's going to bring about a negative purpose, which he might possess as well, right? So you can have an arum which is good and an arum which is bad. But it's somebody who projects what's going to happen in the future. So the question is then, obviously, is that the fact that we understand arum that way, according to way the Malbim understands it, so does that help us understand the other word arum over here? Nope. I think it, yeah. How are they related?
So
that's the other one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You anticipate. This is when you pick out anticipating is going beyond the. It's putting naked something in there. You want to go beyond the idea.
Right. Somebody is a room that means he has perception, right? He perceives the future as good. He's not necessarily a big sage, but he has perception. He can perceive the future. what it's going to bring satisfies accordingly. A person who is naked, who's arum, is perceived by everybody, right? Everybody perceives the inside. It's kind of like the same idea. A perception is something which pierces the veil of the future and gives you a capacity to understand what's going on. A peti doesn't possess that. Whereas, and the same thing, an arum is somebody who is revealed, who's naked, who's unclothed. Something is revealed as a result. Now, this interesting now, so let's go back to the Chumash. Right, so Adam and Chava were Erumim. They were naked and revealed. Right, what page are we on?
14.
Adam and Chava were Arumim, and Nachash Hoya Arum. And the Nachash was Arum, meaning he perceived something about them. Well, he perceived something. What was he able to perceive? That's the interesting thing. What was he able to perceive?
That they were anticipating.
What do you mean they were anticipating?
They had the capacity to think about the future.
Yeah, but they obviously didn't exercise it.
Right.
So,
but that's what
they
asked. Right. So what did he perceive?
He saw that they were naked, and
they
didn't realize that they were naked.
Right. And what did he realize as a result?
As a result, he realized that there wasn't.
Right, so he saw not just necessarily that they're gullible, but if he somehow gets them to think about the fact that they're naked, that they are susceptible to temptation.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, looking at the naked human beings in front of him, he realized that they are susceptible to temptation, and therefore he's going to try and tempt them to go off the beaten path. I don't know if that's true or not true, but that's what I would suppose, that they saw that they were naked, and that gave them the perception this being has the capacity to be tempted somehow. I'm not sure why the Nachash was smarter than Adam and Chava in this respect, but it seems that he was. It seems the Nachash was given greater perception, or at least possessed here greater perception than Adam and Chava themselves. Because Adam and Chava possessed, at least Chava, possessed the same perception as the Nachash, so she would perceive what the Nachash was trying to do to her and how he was trying to deceive her. But obviously that perception the Nachash had and not Adam and Chava.
There's a problem though. We're saying the snake, you're asking how is the snake perceptive? And we were saying that it's perceptive, but since he sees these naked people, but if we're taking the word naked, not just naked, but to mean perceptive, because it's the same word, then he was perceptive that he saw that these people were perceptive? I mean, how are we defining it as naked now, if we defined it as perceptive?
I think that when it says in the passage before, that they were a rumi v'loyis boshashu, that they were perceived. And they weren't embarrassed, it means they had no perception. So, you know, it seems that Hashem created man at this stage with a certain kind of innocence, which is that he doesn't, there are certain things, which perceptions which he doesn't have, which will only come about as a result of the sin. But, but this perception does exist already in the Nachash. He already somehow has this perception, the kind of long-term perspective, in here, of course, it's a coming perspective, how seeing Adam and Chava, seeing what they are, how they're made up, he can twist them and manipulate them in order to accomplish his own ends.
It seems that here the album is, I mean, even though they were, ahead of time, but it's the lack in them, the fact they can anticipate, the Nachash was that failure on their part and weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, he used that weakness to.
Mm-hmm. I think that's something along the line. Anyway, whether we're right or we're wrong, there has to be some connection. In other words, maybe everything we're saying today is completely false, but it won't be the first time. But nevertheless, there must be some connection between the two Erumim. Now, leaving that aside, let's go back to where we were yesterday. Yesterday, we said there was a big dispute between the Talmud and the Kabbalah, in terms of what the Nachash was. I don't know, one of the articles takes a position on this.
Can you repeat what was the equivalent to opinion?
What? But take a look at the article here on page 15. He kind of combines the two. The consensus of the commentators, you see that's the last paragraph in the left-hand column. The consensus of the commentators is that the serpent of the narrative was literally a serpent. They differ regarding what force it represented, the evil inclination, Satan, or the angel of death. According to the Midrash, before this cunning beast was cursed, it stood erect and was endowed with some faculty of communication. Now he's kind of, it seems to me that he's more taking the side of the Kabbalists. Although, if you're a strict Kabbalist, you don't have necessarily believed that the snake was a physical being, right? You can believe that it was a vision or some sort of angelic thing. But, okay, you know, it's not, it could also have been, you know, incarnate, the eighth heart, the evil inclination incarnate. So be that as it may, by the way, the it seems like it said the evil inclination, Satan, or the angel of death, the Gemara says that all three of those entities are the same. They are. Who ate the hara? Who satan, who malach amodesh? Yoredu machti, he comes down and causes you to sin. Oilam the katrig, then he goes up and prosecutes you. The evil inclination, the prosecution, that's Satan. And then, yoredu nozo shama, he comes down and kills you. So he's the angel of death. So it's kind of a kangaroo court, right? He's the he entices you, he prosecutes you, and then he kills you. It all comes together, right?
The angel, I mean, I think of Satan and the evil inclination as malevolent figures. I don't think the angel of death is a malevolent figure.
Well, who told you Satan is malevolent? Gemara says in Barabatra, it says that the Satan is really, he does what he does for the sake of heaven. In other words, the Gemara specifically says there, the reason why Satan tried to make Job sin, right, in the story of the book of Job, where Job was enticed by the Satan, is because he saw that, whatever this means, not to be taken literally, that God was enamored with Job, to the extent that he was afraid that God would prefer Job over his contemporary, which was Avraham Avinu. So therefore he said, I better go down and make Job ill sin, in order that Hashem should not, you know, forsake his special relationship with Avraham. So it's an interesting thing. Again, it's a very strange Gemara. But the Gemara says that Satan was shame Shammayim Yisgach. The Satan does what he does for the sake of heaven. So, you know, I know in Christianity, Satan is regarded as a fallen angel. But in our perspective, no, he's just doing what he's supposed to do. This is his mission. His mission is to bring, you know, free will and balance into the world.
That's
the only way we could say God's ritual. What?
The only way we could say God's ritual.
I guess, maybe. I mean, yeah, okay.
It's funny, I remember when I was a kid, I had a Christian friend, and I told him, you know, talking about the devil or something, and I said, well, isn't the devil a good guy then? Because, you know, he's punishing all these people who did horrible things. Wouldn't that make him good? And he was just like shocked and appalled that I would say something like that.
It was very perceptive of you. Not bad. Yeah. So according to Aristotle Christianity, Satan is an adversary of God, but in our understanding, Satan or evil inclination, all these things are tools which are serving the will of God in making the creation what the creation is. Okay? You don't like that. You look shocked.
That means everything is a tool of God, right?
Right.
So what? How can you say
except what?
Good and bad.
Except what?
Free will
is not
a tool of God.
No,
otherwise
you
don't
have to be. Otherwise, there would be free will
in the world.
God created everything. God has created free will. Yeah.
Right,
and you left it free. Yeah, you're right. Free will is also a tool in a certain way. In other words, free will ultimately serves the purpose of good. When everything, you know, all the issues which surround free will ultimately come. All of the well that ends well. But in the meantime, right, the free will of a certain individual might be pretty bad for him, for the world, and there's going to have to be some compensation and balance for that. So again, everything will work out in the end, you know, somehow. We don't know how, somehow. But in the meantime, that free will has the potential to be evil.
And the person may not be punished necessarily in this world, but the person will be punished by Hitler, or somebody who cheats, and they die a millionaire, you know, or somebody who's righteous and dies, you know, broke. So then, by definition,
there has to be a world to come, an Olam Haba, because if it was only Olam Hazeh, and this person cheated, and they got, you know, where they got to, you know, by cheating, you know, by doing something that's not good, then that would mean that God is not good. But ultimately, there has to be an Olam Haba, because in that world, you know, the cheater is going to get punished, and the good person, you know, the righteous person, the pious person, is going to be rewarded.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be an Olam Haba.
Right, so it's an essential component of the goodness of God, that there be multiple worlds.
Yeah.
You're trying to balance out in the end.
So then, the only thing to be loathed is the improper exercise of free will.
Right. In other words, everything in the world has its purpose. Some things have the purpose that you should stay away from them. You know, so for example, I mean, obviously pigs have purposes in the world, right? The purpose of a Jew is to be a pig is not to eat it. You can have a pig swallow it. There's all sorts of things you can do with a pig. You just have to know how to use it the right way. So everything has its purpose and its use. Some things have uses which are reflected in our negative attitude towards them. But everything is created as part of that purpose. Yeah.
So is it like a test then?
Well, yeah,
Hashem,
of course.
Because, yeah, so it's a test. And then free
right.
will, because without free will, you can't have a relationship. You can't choose
mm-hmm.
good or bad.
So yeah.
There's no free will, and if there was no evil that was created by Hashem, there's no chance to have a relationship with Hashem, because if it was only good, then there's no choice.
Right. The Chassidim take it even further. Some of the Chassidim. They hold that not only is all creation good, but everything you do is also good, and even the sins you do are also good. So they take this perspective, but they hold it anyway. But even the sins you do are good if, as anticipated, you do tshuva afterwards. And the sins, of course, are good as well. Yeah, and even if you don't do tshuva, since in the final analysis everything is going to work out for the best. Retroactively, everything that happened was really good. Even things you did out of your own volition. Does that make any sense?
But
that's the volition. So there are many Hasidim, I shouldn't say many, but the significant schools of some Hasidim, which limit free will, they curtail free will severely. And basically, the only thing you have free will concerning is your attitude. I think I mentioned this in the past. Yeah, we only have free will concerning attitude. Everything else is pre-programmed.
Like what you do is pre-programmed, but how you feel about it is
right.
Pre-programmed.
Our response to it is right. It's up to you. Yeah. There is such a school of thought. So the fact that I just picked this up as pre-programmed to do, right? What I do as a result of how I think about picking it up, that's something which I have the free will. That's an amazing, I mean, the Rambam would hold that such a school of thought is heretical. No, because it denies free will the scope which he gives free will, but that doesn't mean that people didn't hold that was the Rambam. So getting back to this issue here, so there's a very big difference if you hold that the Nachash was Satan, angel of death, right, all that, or if you hold the Nachash was an independent creature who has his own consciousness and his own will. If you hold that this is that the serpent was that the serpent was the evil inclination, then this is the first sin which is committed as a result of the evil inclination which exists in the world. But if you consider this the Nachash to be an independent entity, then in fact this sin was not because of one evil inclination, the evil inclination which is part and parcel of a person's test in this world, but rather they were persuaded by somebody else to do something wrong. The first sin which then occurs as a result of a person's own evil inclination is the sin much later, not much later, but the sin of Cain. When Cain kills Hevel, that would be the first sin ascribed to a person's own motivation, his own Yetzer Hara. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be the serpent Yetzer Hara, the first sin? The serpent, he committed the sin by convincing them to sin, so therefore he committed that sin out of his Yetzer Hara, assuming he had one. If he was a conscious being of free will, then he probably had one, free will, you need one. So then he was going against his free, his evil inclination, he made him cause the other people.
That's true, but for some reason, which is not clear to us, he doesn't count. Right.
The
same. The same, right. So, you know, it's hard for us to understand if he's a conscious, sentient human snake, why he doesn't matter. But somehow in this grand scheme of things, he doesn't matter. He was still an animal after all was said and done. And there's a difference between a man and an animal, even an animal as, you know, advanced as the serpent.
And another question I have, if you consider the snake an incarnation of evil incarnation or a symbolic interpretation, like image of the evil incarnation, then how does that work with the punishment given to the snake of falling on the ground, eating dirt for the rest of his life, and, you know, abandoning from God, and like all those things that we talk about the snake about, and hitting him on the head, and all that stuff? How does that work out with the evil incarnation? How is the evil incarnation growing on his belly eating dust?
Good question. Would that be a symbolism, obviously, at some point? You're right. There has to be, at some point, the symbolism of a snake representing the evil incarnation takes over from it being the evil inclination, right? At that point, the evil inclination left the snake and went somewhere else, which was still very effective. Whereas the snake was then demoted because it had served as a vehicle for the evil inclination, which, it's a good question. We'll have to talk about that, not today, because it's happening much later in the story, but we're going to have to talk about that. But there was something else which I wanted to say about this, this issue of the snake, which is, that there is an opinion in Chazal, and this links to the previous pasuk and this pasuk. There's an opinion in the Medrash, it might be a Gemara even, that says that the snake had a lust for Chara. In fact, the Gemara says somewhere, and I don't think it's necessarily to be taken literally, but it does say this, that the serpent had relations with Chara. What an amazing statement, right? So, if you understand that the Yetzer, the Yetzer Hara, so that means that, some mystical thing happened over there, and the Nachash persuaded her to do what she shouldn't do, and that was it. He had relations with her. He had a relationship with her, obviously. But according to the opinion that the Nachash was really an animal, it seems like this is an actual, literal statement of what the Nachash did, that there was something which went on there, which was somehow, had to do with an intimate relationship which the Nachash wanted to have with Chava. Those are very difficult to understand that. But that does relate to the idea of Arum and Arum, right? That since the Nachash was able to perceive that they were naked, they had no perception that they were naked. But the Nachash had perception that they were naked, so therefore the Nachash had this desire to have this relationship with Chava. Okay? So it would be a way of understanding it. Again, if you understand that the Nachash was a being, not the incarnation of the Yetzer Hara, of the negative incarnation, but if it was a being, so then that actually would make a lot of sense. Okay? So far, so good?
The snake was a guy.
It was a guy, yes. A male snake.
Yes,
yes. Let's look at this time again. Ba-Nachash ha-Yaru mikol chayat ba-Sadeh. So the snake was more cunning, more perceptive, that all the animals of the field, Asher Asah Hashem Elohim, which God made. Now, that means that at this point, the Nachash, as we said, either was the Yetzer Hara, or he was meant to be the foremost among the animals, and he was the highest form of animal short of a human being. Now, generally speaking, after the sin, we define a human being as an entity which talks, right? The way the philosophers divided is, the inanimate, right? Inanimate, which is domain. Then there's that which grows, right? Somea. Then there's that which is alive, that's chai. And then there's that which is medaber, that which speaks. So that's the mineral, vegetable, animal, and human. And what defines human beings is the power of speech. In fact, Unkel, the very famous Unkel, says, before this, if you take a look on the page before, page 10. On page 10 it says in the seventh pasuk here, the third line from the bottom, Vayitzar Hashem Elokim es ha'adam ofer min ha'adama, and Hashem God formed man, the man out of dust from the ground. Vayitach bapa mishmatayim, and he blew into his nostrils the soul of life. So the Oklu says here that he actually, the article brings it down in the second paragraph, in the last paragraph in the right column on page 11, midway through that paragraph, he says, the soul made man a living being, which Unklus defines as a speaking spirit. Accordingly, the life that is unique to man, which only God could blow into him, is the rational soul that includes the power of intelligent speech. This is what elevates a human above the animal life. The ability and therefore the responsibility to use his intelligence in God's service. Well, that's beautiful. But what about the snake? The snake is speaking, right? Right? Well, the donkey, well, it's a miracle. That they say is because the rabbi says a miracle. But this seems to be taken as a man, you know, it's dry, right? So, clearly, he was given a higher capacity than other animals, yet at the same time, he was somehow beneath the level of man. I really don't know how to define that.
Some
animals seem to be
with men more than others.
I mean, yeah, but they don't talk. This is talking.
I mean, at the other time, it was more...
What?
At the other time, it was a kind of talking... The point of talking.
Was, yes, even if a dolphin communicates, dolphins don't have philosophical conversations with man about the nature of God and the universe, right? You know, and what God commands and doesn't command.
They say, I want
to answer. Yes, that's right. That's swim. But here, we are having actually a very profound conversation about what God commanded and didn't command. So clearly this speech, which the Nuggets had, was not just woof-woof, you know, something more profound going on than that. So, what? I really don't know.
I have one possible answer. I mean, I think it was written in the article, of course, that it's not the first world, there were many worlds before, and the information comes from a previous world before, meaning the kind of people, and therefore it doesn't have to be recreated, he's there from before. And then
no, as I understand it, in fact, it's the evil inclination, I don't have a problem with that. It's fine. It can talk because it's higher, so it's even easier to be angelic. But I'm talking about the ability to be as low as
you
can.
What?
Yeah. So what defines the difference between a human being and a snake? The snake can talk. The snake is cunning. It's very perceptive, right? He has desires. So what's the difference between him and a human being?
He's called a
chaya. Right. He's called a chaya. So what makes him a chaya? Which mitzvah was he not commanded? Okay, well, command not to eat from the tree, that may be.
But he wasn't commanded that, but he wasn't obligated. He could not be in a bear, whereas Adam could. He was below them because God never gave him a directive.
Yeah, see, what you're saying is true, but it doesn't really satisfy me. What you're saying is that, well, clearly, the Nachash was lower because he didn't receive any commands. And man got all these commands already. He was told not to eat from the Eitz HaDaat. He was told to preserve the Garden of Eden, to maintain it. He was told that he should conquer the world. So he was given all these directives already. He has a whole slew of things he has to accomplish.
Right.
Whereas the Nachash seems to have nothing inherently to accomplish.
He has no meaning in
his life. Right, he has no meaning in his life. It's a very powerful way of putting it. He has no meaning in his life. But that just begs the question, why is he like that? So what is the purpose of having this type of creation in the world?
So that he can do what he's about to do. That's okay. We say this type of creation, meaning evil, or this type of creation meaning specifically...
No, this animal. This type of animal. This higher form of animal.
Were they to understand if the snake had split up because it had legs, or because it split up because the cobra stand up?
No, it has legs, because later on it loses its legs. That's part of the curse.
So this is saying it has sort of like this lizardy, snake-like creature with little legs that stood and talked to people.
Well, we know it didn't look like a lizard at the time. It looked like before the curse. Let's assume so, right. But we don't know that's a certainty. So, It's a very, very difficult thing. This not just going to about that. But I want to read you a little bit more.
To start reading that tonight. For the others, there'll be nothing.
Said, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bezerra Omer. Rabbi Yehuda ben Bezerra said, Adam HaRishon, Hoya Meisi B'Gan Eden, Adam was reclining in the Garden of Eden, U'malachi HaShoreth Oimdi B'Gan Eden Likoso, and the angels stood opposite him, with some Lebasar, and they were barbecuing for a meat, V'Nsanil Lion at Yayin, and they were, wining and dining, but the wine, when you pass the wine through like a cheesecloth, what's this called?
Straining
the wine. Ba'nachash, the snake came, v'ra'o also, and he saw Adam, ve'etit b'kvodo, and he perceived his honor, v'nitzkaribo, and he was jealous of him. So the snake not only was able to speak, but he actually had jealousy, right? And the whole thing happened because the snake was jealous of Adam. That here Adam has this whole great spread, and he's a snake. He's just looking like a snake, whatever that was at the time. So,
was he jealous of Adam because of the beast?
Well, here it says it's specifically about the food. I don't think it brings down here the idea of the Russian world. But here it says
what's the Russian bring it down here?
That God knows how to have
it? No, that
Yeah, I think he does bring it down, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Right, he says the Rashi here does say that. And he brings it down from where it doesn't say. But in the first pasuk here, Rashi does say, as you said, that he saw them involved in procreation, and he had a desire for them. That's interesting.
The snakes, what are they? Are they eggs, right?
What?
Some snakes like eggs.
Yeah, but I think it's going to be appropriate, don't they?
Right, but they don't... I don't know how they do it, but... It's not like humans, though.
No, it's not like humans. No, but I think they have a gestation period. I think they are... It's not eggs. I think they actually... it's not a mammal, but I don't know exactly what... I don't want to say.
Right.
So anyway, let me read you a bit more about this. Yosemar, my question is... Ma'achoshav, nochash, or rosha, those are short. What did the snake think at that time? Eilech v'arog et Adam, I'm going to go and kill man. V'etzot ishton, I'm going to marry his wife. V'yem melech ha'kohom kulon, I'll be king over the entire world. V'yem v'kom v'kufa, I will walk, straight up. V'ocha kom adon yoylam, and I'm going to eat all the delicacies of the world. So these were the nochash's ambitions and aspirations. So Hashem said, I saw Martha. You said, Eroget to Adam, I'm going to kill man, that's Chavan, I'm going to marry Chava. Therefore, I'm going to make animosity between you and him, your race and his race. I saw Martha, Melech HaKololam, you said I'm going to be king over the entire world. Lefichach, therefore, Ora Tami Kol Behemu, you are more cursed than any animal. I told him to El the Koyim as Kufa, you said you want to walk upright. Lefichach, the Chol Chol Teyach, that's why you're going to slither on your stomach. I told him to Chol Chama Adani, you only said you're going to eat all the delicacies. Lefichach, for Tocha Koyim Echech, that's why you're going to eat dirt all of your life. Now, Rabbi Shimon Ben Menashe Oiner, Rabbi Shimon Menashe says, Chaval, whoa! Al Shamish Gadol Sha'ava Min Olam on this great servant which was lost from the world. Shemole Niskalo Nochash, were not that the Nochash was cursed. Each and every Jew would have shtei nechashim b'sof beitam. Would have two snakes inside his house. Why two? Echad mishagro l'mamarav, one he would send to the west. Echad mishagro mizrach, and one he would send to the east. U'mevi'im lo, and they would bring him sometimes lachim tovim, so a sort of precious commodity. Avonim tovos, precious stones. U'margoliot, and pearls. V'kol kli chemed b'shetay shuk oilam. And any precious vessel in the world. V'ein kol biria v'chol lo lachzik otam. Nobody would be able to restrain them. V'lo od, not only that, they would use them instead of camels, tachas chamor, instead of donkeys, parrot and mule, and they would be the ones to go out and fertilize the fields for us. Right? Yeah. So this is you're not the first one to come up with that. So amazing thing that the Nachash was created to be the servants of man, right? And the reason why he bought that role is because he became jealous of man. He wanted not to be the servant, but he wanted to be the master.
So what is the snake handler?
An interesting theory. So again, I can't tell you, based on all this wonderful description of what the Nachash was pre-sin, what exactly distinguished the Nachash from man. It's not clear. But what it does say to us here is that the Nachash was supposed to be the servant class, so to speak, underneath man. And man was supposed to be able to have the capacity to harness the super servant in order to get things done in the world. And of course, since he sinned and the Nachash sinned, so the ramifications occur in which that man has to work for himself, right? There's a Bechtel Cholom, as one of your bread, you'll eat bread, and the Nachash lost whatever chance he had to be this great servant of man. Yeah?
Question about the description. It says that the snake desired to be able to stand upright, and therefore is punished by having his foot on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So what was he doing before?
Yeah,
obviously he wasn't standing upright if he wanted to. He wasn't sitting on the ground either. He was like a four-legged creature, or...
I don't know. Maybe he wants to remain that way permanently. It's a good question. I don't see somebody speak about it here. It's not clear. Maybe it was like an angle. I don't know. It's not clear. So in any event, after all said and done, the Nachash is an enigmatic figure. Again, according to the Gemara, he clearly was an entity which had free will and choice and decided, he was jealous and he was going to do something about it. According to the Kabbalist, as we said, he's not an entity which has free will necessarily. Perhaps he had no free will whatsoever. His job, for which he was created, was to come down and entice Chava and Adam in order to get them to sin.
We understand there was one serpent and not, there's two people and there's various other animals, four dogs or something, but... Are we to understand that there's just one serpent that was the only serpent created in the whole world?
Yeah, I don't know.
If that's the case, wouldn't God, God knows everything, you would know that it's crazy.
So obviously they're going to procreate because everybody was supposed to have two of them.
Right. So
there must have been another serpent. Right, must have been another serpent. There must have been the serpent class, which had this role. Okay. But the truth is, we're not here, the purpose of our conversation about these things is not actually to define the Nachash, but to define sin and what sin does. So whatever the Nachash was, we say he was Vayermel Isha. He came and he spoke to man, to woman. Now that's an important thing to remember. The Medrash says, and the Gemara says all sorts of things about the Nachash's desires. His jealousy, his desires, all those motivations, right? Which are important. But we have to understand them in the context of what the Chumash says. So first we have to see what the Chumash says and work our way to Chazal and then see how Chazal fit into the Chumash, right? So the Chumash doesn't begin with saying the Nachash made bad choices. It begins with saying that the Nachash came to the woman, right? And again, because whatever the Nachash's choices were, they're not important to us. So I don't know why, but they're not important to us. What's important to us is how there was an interaction between the woman and the Nachash which led to the Avera being committed, right? Is that clear? not according to what the Nachash felt or heard or did. What we support is what happens in the interaction. So it says, "Vayomer Yisro," he said to the woman, "Af kiyamar lokim lo sochumi kol eis agon." Now, of course, the Nachash, as we said, is very cunning. So what is his question? His question is it in fact true that God told you you're not allowed to eat from any of the trees in the garden?
How did he know?
He was lying.
How did he know?
He knew very well the answer.
Yeah, but how?
What?
Where did he know? How did
everybody
know?
We imagine that when God said it, everybody in Gan Eden found out about it. Yeah. Otherwise, what's his premise here? You know, he obviously knew something about it, right? Certainly, if he's the Yetzer Hara, it's not a question, right? Because he knows about this. But it's interesting. Of course, that the first question that the first thing he does is tries to have a conversation, and the conversation begins with a distortion, right? Now, this is a very important point, because the Rambam says that before the first thing, man had free will. But the free will man had before the first sin was the free will to choose between truth and falsehood. After the sin, the choice is not between truth and falsehood anymore, but between good and evil. It's a very, very powerful statement. The question is how we understand that. We're already out of time for today. But at this point, the way the Chumash is describing the interaction, there is no overt statement about the Nachash's motivations. What we're doing is we're focusing on Chava, and we see that Chava is being led astray by lies. So the beginning of sin, the initial, and he was lying, because he knew the answer to the question. He raised the question, but he knew the answer. And he was doing it in order to deceive her. So the initial beginning of sin is deception. Everything begins with deception. Who deceives you? Okay. Sometimes somebody else deceives you. Sometimes you deceive yourself. Mm-hmm. But the first step is deception. We'll have to take it from there next week.
I wouldn't mind having a little dinosaur.